Testing.
House Committee on Business and Consumer Affairs, Subcommittee Number 1, on Thursday, March 21, 1991, at 1 p.m. in Hearing Room H-170. Today's agenda is a public hearing and a possible work session on House Bill 2306, House Bill 2308, and a work session on House Bill 2181 and 2696.
So we're going to be taking testimony on House Bill 2306. The clerk will please note those present. So I would like to have Mr. Gribling come up. And welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let the record show that we now have a quorum, so we'll revert back to our subcommittee procedures. Go right ahead, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Ray Gribling, and I represent the Oregon Automobile Dealers Association. And I have with me today Mr. Craig Nichols, who is counsel to the association, on my right, and Mr. Larry Winans, who is the director of fixed operations for Capital Chevrolet here in Salem. They made themselves available to answer any questions the committee might have. House Bill 2306 would modify the Oregon Dealer Franchise Act and its operation to protect Oregon's automobile dealers in the courts. Section 2 provides that a dealer may enjoin the manufacturer, distributor, or importer, franchisor, if you will, from the prohibited conduct under certain conditions. The way that a dealer enjoins the prohibited conduct is to file a lawsuit. However, the actions of the manufacturer during the pendency of the lawsuit become critical to the protesting dealer. The battleground then becomes whether or not the dealer will be able to stop the manufacturer from the prohibited conduct during the pendency of the legal action. The legal threshold for institution of a preliminary injunction is determined by whether or not irreparable injury is occurring to, in this case, the automobile dealer. Therefore, whether the prohibited conduct is the termination of a franchise or the establishment of a new franchise, and whether the factory can take the threatened action during the pendency of the lawsuit, depends on the preliminary injunction. That in turn depends on whether or not the dealer can establish irreparable injury to his or her dealership during the pendency of the trial. Show cause hearings are normally held a short time after filing a petition for a preliminary injunction. This is where the dealer's problems begin because he normally does not have access to the necessary information needed to establish irreparable harm, whereas the manufacturers have at their fingertips more than enough data to establish any point they desire. Therefore, I think you will agree, the dealer attempting to protect his investment using the legal remedy of the Dealer Franchise Act is at a distinct disadvantage under the Act as it is written today. The language we have proposed in House Bill 2306 would put the dealers on a level playing field with the manufacturers with regard to the application of the Dealer Franchise Act. The language is central to any attempt by a dealer to protect his investment through the use of the Act. We've seen in several situations the inability of dealers to meet the irreparable injury threshold, not because there was not injury to the dealership, but simply because they did not have adequate time to gather information to support their case prior to a preliminary injunction hearing. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, at the beginning of my testimony, I referred to prohibited conduct on the part of the manufacturer, distributor, or importer. While the bill references ORS 650-120 to 650-170, I realize that neither you nor I have memorized these citations, so in an effort to further describe all the things that can go wrong, I have attached to the back of my testimony a copy of 650-130, which should give the committee a feel for the issue we are addressing. And now, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'd like to cover with you the amendments we are proposing to House Bill 2306 that your committee administrator, Mr. Connolly, was kind enough to have drafted for us. ORS 650-160 speaks to reimbursement of franchise new car dealers for warranty work and claims by dealers. We'd like to delete the current language and substitute it with the language before you. Section 3, Sub 1, requires the manufacturer to specify in writing the dealer's obligations for pre-delivery preparation and warranty, the schedule of compensation and the time allowance for such warranty work. Sub 2 requires the schedule to include reasonable compensation for diagnostic work as well as for repair service and labor. Compensation shall be based upon rates as reflected in publications relied upon by the automotive repair industry. And further, the hourly rate paid to the dealer for warranty parts, service, and repairs shall not be less than the rate charged by the dealer to non-warranty customers. Sub 3 requires the manufacturer to provide written notices of recalls to new vehicle owners and dealers, including the expected date that parts will be available to correct the defects resulting in the recall. Again, compensation will be expected as described in Sub 2. Sub 4 requires that all claims made by the dealer shall be paid or credited within 30 days following their approval. The manufacturer has the right to audit all claims and charge back the dealer for fraudulent claims for a period of 2 years. All claims shall be either approved or disapproved within 30 days after receipt in the manner specified by the manufacturer. Any claim not specifically disapproved in writing or through electronic communication shall be deemed approved and payment made within 30 days. This concludes my testimony, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'd like to thank you for your time on behalf of the Oregon Automobile Dealers, and we're available for any questions.
Thank you. Any questions of the committee members? Representative Nato.
Are these 2306-1 amendments your proposed amendments?
Yes.
I'm just interested in that. You see a need that this be statutorily required rather than just in the individual contract between the dealer and the manufacturer?
Sure.
Would you please state your name for the record?
Chairman, my name is Craig Nichols. I'm the legal counsel for the Oregon Auto Dealers. I don't believe the manufacturer can take this action on their own and insert this in the franchise agreement. And it's not the type of provision that an automobile dealer is going to be able to negotiate for in that setting. Normally, the franchise agreement is set down in front of them, and it's either a sign or don't sign situation. There's not much bargaining about it.
Any further questions, Representative Nadel?
Yes. Do you know of, as legal counsel, I'm also interested in, do you know of other situations? I know it's always difficult to get an injunction, and do you know of other types of situations that have been statutorily deemed to be an irreparable injury in other kinds of cases?
Right now, that's the threshold per case law. Okay. And where this came from, Wisconsin statutes, Wisconsin was one of the first states to enact the Dealer Franchise Act, and they included this provision in their act. And what we found in attempting to use the Oregon Dealer Franchise Act is just too short a period of time to gather the information necessary to, in effect, the temporary injunction hearing becomes the hearing on good cause to stop the prohibited action by the manufacturer. And there's just not enough time. And that's why this is included in the statute in Wisconsin, and it should be here.
Follow-up question?
Yes.
My question was not so much whether this exists in other states, but whether, and I can find this out later if you don't know, just feel free to say that, but if we have other types of things, say in landlord-tenant law or other areas that we deem statutorily to constitute irreparable injury for purposes of a show cause.
Would you explain a little bit what you mean by irreparable harm? Is this sort of like you can't make the dealership whole again? Where would these circumstances occur as they relate to the manufacturer?
The term irreparable harm is basically a judicial standard that is necessary for the institution of a temporary injunction. I'm not sure that it has any...
You're speaking to a layman, that's the reason why I ask.
In terms of being able to quantify what that harm is to the dealership, I don't know that you can actually do that. That's why, in order to meet that standard without this statute, you need a great deal of information. Most of that information has to come from the manufacturer itself, a great deal of that information, or it has to be generated by the dealership, which is a costly process also. So with this standard, if we had this statute in effect, basically what would happen is the manufacturer could not take the activity or be involved in the activity which is already deemed to be unlawful if the manufacturer has filed his petition seeking a hearing on good cause. And it's kind of complicated. I lost my train of thought there. But the information would then be able to, there would be sufficient time to generate that information. That's really what it's about. It's a battle of information.
I see. Okay, thank you. Any other questions of committee members?
Yes,
Representative Scoon.
The repeal of 651-60. Ask if this language substitutes the provisions being repealed in 650-160, or just what it does.
Pardon me, Mr. Chair. Representative Schoon, was you were directing the question.
Well, the proposed amendments, Section 4, reads that ORS 650-160 is repealed. And I was quickly trying to figure out what the effect of that was.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Schoon, 650-160 would be repealed, replaced by this language. Now, whether it's casted in the ORS, I'm not sure. But this language basically replaces sub 1 and 2 of 650-160.
Are there other states that have provisions similar to what you're proposing?
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
I was just curious if we're breaking new ice here in dealing.
We have with us today the Executive Vice President of the Oregon Automobile Dealers Association, locally known as Rich Keister.
Yeah, welcome. Can you
answer that question?
Yeah, if you state your name for the record.
Yes, Rich Keister, the Auto Dealers. Mr. Chairman, I have in my upper hand here some place to list of states that are currently either passed or are in the process of passing similar language. As I find it, there's 8 or 10 that are in the process right now. Some states have had it for some time. If you'd like, I'll read them.
Sure, please.
Texas, Illinois, New Jersey, Arizona, Missouri, Indiana, Montana, Utah, Alabama, Georgia, and Rhode Island. To get maybe to Representative Schoon's question, I think I can maybe respond. The current statute permits the manufacturer to reimburse the dealer at the posted labor rate for warranty work as long as reason. Fortunately, I manufacturer will pay them dollars per hour, but they don't allow enough time. So the effective rate that they're paying for a given operation is reduced. So that's the reason for part of the repeal of that section.
Any further questions, Representative Schoon? Is there an agency relationship between the manufacturer and the individual dealerships? Agency meaning any type of fiduciary relationship or anything like that? I guess maybe the attorney.
Well, when you say agency to a lawyer, that means there's a specific legal relationship. And as for fiduciary relationship, there's a number of relationships that exist between the dealer and the
I guess the point I was making is the dealership a child of the manufacturer, I suppose, in that term. Otherwise, is the manufacturer responsible for what the dealership does or doesn't do? I just wonder if we're trying to dictate to the parent for something that the child wants, if you follow my relationship.
I think maybe the best way to answer that is that the legislature already saw fit through the Dealer Franchise Act to protect the investment of the franchisees, the franchisor, the dealer who's invested the amount of money that they've invested in their franchises, their operation. As for kind of a parent-child relationship, I don't see that. I think what the legislature was trying to do, and this has developed over time, was put them on an equal footing so that if they're independent businesses buying a product from the manufacturer and turning around and selling that to the public.
Okay, well, that was, no, that's fine. I wondered, is there a close enough legal relationship there besides a contractual relationship? Apparently there isn't. These both are separate entities.
But the relationship is definitely determined by contract. That's what a franchise agreement is. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? You gentlemen have anything else you'd like to add?
I might Rich Easter get Representative Nato's question, if I remember correctly. You asked regarding the ability of the dealer to negotiate with the manufacturer on some of these issues. I have here, that's only one copy, but I did bring along just to show you that General Motors, for instance, will write the franchise agreement in Detroit with maybe some or no input from the manufacturer or from the dealer body. And every 5 years it's renewed. So they'll go around to all the General Motors dealers, maybe 6,000 of them in the United States, and essentially say, there it is, you want to be a dealer tomorrow or not. You do sign the agreement that you're no longer AAA dealer. So there really is no opportunity for the small dealer in Oregon to negotiate down motor Detroit and Dearborn on issues such as this. This has been a real thorn in the dealer side for many years, and one of the things that's brought it to the stage, I guess it is right now, is the extended warranties that are wonderful for the consumers, but are a real detriment to the business of the dealer who has to do this warranty repair work. And I'm not going to suggest to you that they take the loss by doing the warranty repairs, but they certainly don't make the kind of profit they're entitled to and they wouldn't normally get. They still have to buy the parts, inventory the parts, and then the manufacturer at their wouldn't say whim necessarily, but they do have the opportunity to audit all the warranty claims. And if they see that it's not the apartment was bought that was not from Chrysler, but it was put on your car because we needed to get you on the road. It was bought apart from the local parts house. Warranted 1999. So they can audit that and discharge the parts house. In fact, I talked to a dealer recently. It's an Astoria. He was reviewing his parts account and found a $30-some charge posted. Didn't understand what that was. And so he reviewed it. The manufacturer found out that they charged him posting for the recall for the vehicle in his area. And this charge of the dealer supposed to be the recall. And you can see that we have a bit of a handicap negotiating.
Yes, Representative.
Could I just maybe elaborate on that a little bit? So, I mean, in lots of businesses, like say you want to put a lease in a mall, you get a lease that big. And sometimes you have the ability to negotiate it, sometimes you don't. It depends on how how anxious the person is to get you into the space, shall we say. If somebody wanted to negotiate a contract like that, bring in their lawyer and say, we can't accept this or that. You're just saying that just doesn't happen because of the power of the manufacturers?
I've been at the Dealers Association for 20 years and have never known that to happen where they modify the standard sales and service.
As an association, do you have any power to negotiate on behalf of all the dealers or not?
The National Association does make efforts to negotiate and to have some input on some parts of the franchise business. And they've been somewhat successful with some lines and less so with others.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Coon.
Who wants to respond?
Oh, I'm sorry. Go right ahead.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nato, there was just something I wanted to relate to you just briefly. First of all, these franchise agreements affect thousands of dealers across the country and internationally, so they're very reluctant to change anything. The second thing, a good example of something that happened recently that the legislature took care of in the last session was a local dealer in Corvallis refused to sign a franchise agreement that had a provision in it that indicated that if there was any legal disputes concerning any of the concerning any disputes between the franchise and the manufacturer, that the venue for those disputes would be the Southern District, the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of California. Well, unfortunately, Mazda and this dealer got into a dispute. And the first thing they did was attempted to move the venue out of U.S. District Court in Portland to Southern California. And they were successful because of the franchise agreement. Fortunately, the legislature changed that and made that illegal conduct on the part of the manufacturer in the last session. But that's an example of how the manufacturers misuse the franchise agreement.
Yes, Representative Schoon.
I'm sure you're going to think I didn't hear a word you said, but I don't understand what the proposed amendment does. To support the problem of not having enough time to respond or to prepare for the injunction. We're changing quite a bit of other, we're adding quite a bit actually to the existing legislation. And so if this is not the problem, why are you adding it all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoon, we're addressing two problems with this same bill. We're making it so that the dealer, by proving that there is a violation of the Dealer Franchise Act, can prove irreparable harm for purposes of getting a temporary injunction. One, that deals with the franchise agreement. The amendments to the bill deal with manufacturer reimbursement to the dealer for warranty work.
And the existing language is not satisfactorily take care of that, I think?
In our opinion, that's right, sir.
Okay, one other question. And that's the parts portion of this. I'm not sure I understand exactly what the relationship is between the dealer and the manufacturer on warranty work in the first place, but it adds that reimbursement for parts, which isn't covered in current statutes, I think, should be reimbursed by the manufacturer at the price charged non-warranty customers. Is there no relationship between you, the dealers, and the manufacturers that would provide for some lesser amount? Knowing that those are typically, I think, doubled in cost, doubles in cost.
Well, Chair and Reference Spoon, I think Mr. Wyden's here can probably address that.
Mr. Chair, the inequities that tend to appear with our lack of ability to negotiate, I think, can be one example. Move away from parts for just a moment. One facility here with a retail rate, which was quite marketable, or you can't stay in business if it's not, took 3 years with the manufacturer to reach parity. That just happened the first part of this month. As an example of where I believe the need is here for some change is to give the dealers the ability to just not have to parent-child negotiate. For questions on parts, pretty much the same situation exists. They restrict dramatically their markup processes, sale and margin processes, as compared to our current market conditions in any particular locale within the state or across the country.
You mean for warranty work?
Yes.
Question, Representative Walden. Do you have any questions for these gentlemen while we have them here?
No. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate you coming. Do we have anyone else that would like to testify on this matter? Hearing none, then let me close the public hearing. For the committee, I'd like to draw your attention to the fact that you have a letter in your packet from the Motor Vehicle Manufacturers Association. And I think rather than holding a work session, if it pleases the committee, we have a number of significant amendments. I think perhaps we need a chance to look them over. So we'll deal with that subject later on. Let me now open the public hearing on House Bill 2308, and we have Mr. Tim Martinez. Welcome. Good afternoon.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee, my name is Tim Martinez. I'm the legislative director of the Oregon Bankers Association. HB 2308 is intended to clarify that retail installment contracts and security agreements entered into by a creditor who must also comply with the Federal Reserve Regulation Z, known commonly as Truth in Lending, will be deemed to be in compliance with the disclosure provisions of ORS Chapter 83. Otherwise, such a creditor would be forced to comply with both the disclosure requirements of Reg Z and Chapter 83. Currently, ORS 83.810 states that, quote, any retail installment contract or security agreement which complies with the disclosure requirements of Title I of the Federal Consumer Protection Act, Public Law 93.21, and then there's an additional site, which is also known as the Truth in Lending Act, as of the date upon which said retail installment contract or security agreement is executed, shall be deemed to comply with the disclosure provisions of ORS 83.010 to 83.840 and 83.990, and no other disclosure is necessary, end quote. In other words, current law provides that if a creditor is in compliance with the more rigorous disclosure requirements of the federal law, you need not comply with the Oregon chapter. This has been Oregon law since 69, and it's worked well. Why then do we need to change it? Why are we concerned? Our concern comes because of the language that I've just recited, which is contained in ORS 83.810, which this bill would repeal. We are concerned that a constitutional question could be raised with regard to the delegation by the Oregon legislature to the Congress of the United States. In effect, we've said as long as you comply with federal law, you're in compliance with state law. We believe, phrased thusly, the provisions of ORS 83.810 could be found to be an unlawful delegation of legislative authority, particularly in that it not only deals with Regulation Z provisions now in effect, but those that might be implemented in the future as well. We propose then to place in the Oregon statute the qualifiers from Reg Z that currently make one subject to the federal act, both as a retail seller or as the assignee of any retail installment contract. It is our sincere intent that 2308 be legislatively neutral. We merely intend to prevent a potential question to the current language. Since House Bill 2308 has been in print, we've had several conversations with interested parties and consequently believe that the amendments attached to my testimony would make it absolutely clear that the bill is strictly